The sages, the mystics, the seers, the travelers, the sailors, the charmers, the thieves, the scholars, all sang praises to the night. For whom can hurt us whilst the moon above me glows? Recited one sailor, even as he dug his own grave under the night moon. One can spy and cut and steal and touch. There is magic in the night, even joy. But the old ones remember a special kind of darkness where there is no moon, where the night turns thick, where those that have passed are given voice and things that were buried are buried no more. Unholy, cursed, haunted. On this Stamp Judgment, we're going to explore a different type of darkness. We proudly present Spooked 7, Pitch Black. Stories ripped from the night. My name is Glenn Washington. Twinkle, twinkle, little star. I hope you are listening to Snap Judgment.
Snap Judgment, Snap Judgment.
Snappers, we start out the Pitch Black Spooked 7 special in the land that lies very close to the Veil, Ireland, where Shane Dunphy spent years working with kids as a social worker. He thought he'd seen it all until he met a little boy named Gregory. And Snappers, due to the extremely sensitive nature of what you are about to hear, some names have been changed. Snap Judgment.
There's a small coastal town in Ireland that locals call the most westerly point in Europe. But it can feel like the last place on Earth. To the east, it's cut off by miles and miles of dense woods.
The Finnegans, they lived just on the edge of these woods. So I found it extremely difficult to get there.
It was 2007, and Shane Dunphy was fairly new to town. As he made his way to the Finnegans for a house visit, he couldn't see any clear street signs to follow.
You go off one little country lane, down another by road, off another little laneway. The trees seem to close in overhead as you come up to the house. This tiny little sort of two up, two down workers' cottage, which looks like something out of Grimm's fairy tales. It was quite eerie. So I arrive out and I meet Gregory.
Shane had learned that Gregory was continuously sneaking off at night into the woods.
He had reddish blonde hair, grayish blue eyes. He was maybe a little bit on the small side, and he doesn't really want to talk to me. As everyone imagines when you work with kids that, you know, conversation flows immediately, and it didn't at all. He pretty much froze when he saw me, and what I did was I played this game with him. Okay, I'm going to ask you questions. You can shake your head for no, nod for yes. Okay, so you go to school in the village and he nods for yes. And I say, okay, and your teacher is a 6 foot tall blue bunny rabbit. And of course he laughs and says no. And we go on like this. And eventually he admits that he does go out at night into the woods to play and that he snuck out at night to meet this other friend. And he told me that this other little boy was called Thomas. Now, this is the first I'd heard of this. Certainly Orla, the mum, hadn't mentioned it. So I thought, right, this is interesting. And so I asked him, where did you meet Thomas? Did you meet him in school? Did you meet him in church? You know, did you meet him on the internet? But he shakes his head no to all of these questions. Look, Gregory, you're going to have to tell me, where did you meet this guy? And he tells me that he heard him. And I said, what? You heard him? And so he brings me up to his room. His bedroom is a tiny little space. There's some posters up on the wall of like football players and Formula One cars. There's a little dresser, and then there's a window looking out onto their little backyard, which exits out through a little gateway into the woods. And he says, I heard him calling me from down there. And he said, I got up and I went to the window and I looked out, and there was this little boy standing just under that tree over there. The little boy saw him and beckoned to him. And he told me that Thomas was living alone in the woods. I told him, maybe I should meet him. Maybe he's hungry, maybe he's frightened. Gregory was absolutely adamant that Thomas did not like adults, was afraid of adults. Their world was just between the two of them. I'd worked an awful lot with kids who were habitual runaways, and they're either running to something or they're running away from something. I felt that this was a very lonely, very isolated little family. You know, the dad, he had left them. The mom was working three jobs. He was lonely. So I thought it was absolutely normal and reasonable for Gregory to create a little playmate for himself. Gregory has an imaginary friend.
Before leaving the Finnegans that evening, Shane told the mom to start inviting Gregory's friends over or have him join a soccer club or youth group.
Anything to get him an outlet so that he doesn't feel the need for this. And I reckon that the running away and the imaginary friend will disappear. About 2 weeks later, I think it's over the lunch break actually that I got the phone call. And it was from a police officer who immediately said, you've been doing some work with the Finnegans, or the mum said you might have some input into what's happened.
Gregory had disappeared the night before. The cops didn't find him until the next morning, miles away from home in the thick of the woods. Gregory said he'd been playing hide and seek with Thomas, and that Thomas was still nearby. But the cops found no trace of the boy. Well, except for one thing. When they got back to Gregory's house, they searched the area outside his window.
And they discover two sets of footprints. The guard, Harry, showed me a photograph of one of the sets of footprints with some measuring tape beside it for scale.
One set of footprints was larger than the other, but they both clearly belonged to children.
My heart dropped because I thought, oh my gosh, Thomas is real. And that really frightened me. Is Thomas being used to lure Gregory into something really, really sinister? I've been involved in cases before in the past where children were used to literally draw kids into paedophile rings, child abuse situations. Now, that doesn't happen every day, but these are realities. So the big question on everybody's lips was, who is this child?
Shane talked to Gregory's mom again and told her to put a bolt or a padlock on all the doors and to hide the keys so that Gregory cannot escape anymore.
I was starting to feel a certain sense of responsibility towards the family at this point. And also I was starting to, I liked Gregory. I thought he was a nice kid. I thought he was interesting and funny. And, you know, I kind of started to quite enjoy hanging out with him. So one afternoon we went out for ice cream.
Shane wanted to see if he could get Gregory to open up a bit more about Thomas. And he did.
Gregory, he was really at that particular time enjoying games on his PlayStation. And then he said, actually, Thomas doesn't have a PlayStation and he doesn't have an Xbox. And I said, well, what does he like then? What games does he play? And Gregory told me that he had a Speccy. I immediately said to him, do you mean a ZX Spectrum? And he said, yeah, that's it. That's what he has.
The ZX Spectrum was a game console popular in the 80s.
And this is what really jarred with me. He said the two games that he says are his favorites are Manic Miner and School Days. Now, these were the two big games when I would have been about 13 or 14 years old. So we're talking 1984, 1985. You know, I was really fascinated by this. What else? And he said, well, what's the A-Team? Thomas tells me it's his favorite show. Again, I'm bowled over. The A-Team. I said, well, that's like an action show that was on, again, when I was a kid. Gregory mimicked one of the catchphrases from Mr. T. He said, I pity the fool who doesn't like the A-Team. What the hell is all of this about? This child, Thomas, who was a huge dilemma and mystery and a cryptic something that I couldn't even understand, who was engaging in all the things that I engaged with, there was a part of me that was drawn to it. But hang on a minute, we've stopped you getting out. I said, so how are you seeing Thomas then? And he said to me that Thomas is getting in. How do you mean he's getting in? Explain that to me. He said to me, I wake up at night and he's in my room. Now that sent a chill right down my spine. I felt a very powerful sense of urgency that we needed to get to the bottom of this before something really terrible happened. And I did, I pushed him again, you know, look, I really need to meet him. And he's just like, no, absolutely not. I had come home quite late one evening. I'd had a really rough day at work and I'd kind of fallen asleep. And I remember being woken up by my cell phone ringing. It was Orla on the other end and she was really upset, very agitated. And she asked me, could I come out to the house really quickly because something had happened. I said to Rena, look, should I call the police on my way out? Has somebody tried to break in? She said, no, that the police can't help us with this. Now, that kind of freaked me out a little bit. I thought, oh my gosh, what has gone on? I got in my car, got out there as quickly as I could. She brought me into the kitchen and she had an old cassette recorder sitting on the kitchen table. She said, play that. So I played it. Had to actually pick it up and almost put it to my ear to hear what was being said. Gradually, I realized what I was hearing was two distinct voices. One of which was clearly Gregory's. Gregory saying, no, Mammy gets afraid when I go outside to play with you. But the other was slightly lower and sounded almost as if it were coming from an older child. I could hear the other child's voice becoming quite annoyed, quite agitated. You know, look, you know, you have to play fair. It's your turn. You need to come out with me now. She got the sense that he had stood up. And at that point on the recording, I heard Orla, Gregory's mother, bursting in. I heard her saying, you know, Gregory, are you all right? She told me that when she went into the room, Gregory was on his own. But she said the window was open and on the rug on the bedroom floor, there was soil and pine needles and little twigs as if somebody who had been walking around in the woods had been standing there.
Shane went out back, and he did see a drain pipe running up the side of the house right beside Gregory's window. He figured that was how Thomas was getting in. For the sake of the mom, Shane threw out another possible explanation.
Could it be Gregory pushing the fantasy to a new level where he's creating these two voices himself? But usually when children do that, they're very, very deeply psychiatrically disturbed. And that just wasn't Gregory. I was just telling myself that these were just two frightened little boys who had found each other and somebody needed to help them.
Shane sat down with Gregory again. He had to ask him who he thought Thomas really was.
The words he used was Thomas was from the woods, almost as if he was a part of the woods. To be honest with you, it kind of slightly gave me the creeps to hear him say it, because I felt that maybe he did understand an awful lot more than we assumed he did.
Shane hadn't really talked about this situation with anybody outside the family, so he confided in the school principal, who was also a friend and could perhaps shed some light on this mysterious boy who lived in the woods.
He kind of suggested that I had somehow stepped into kind of like a rural legend about a girl who had become pregnant by her father. The father had brought her out into the woods, to a cabin, and he had kept her there and made her have her child in this shack. And the story went that she gradually became crazier and lonelier and more estranged, and she took to wandering the paths of the forest. If she were alive today, would have been the closest neighbour to the Finnegan family.
Shane dug up some newspaper clippings about this local legend that dated back to the mid-1980s. One mentioned that the woman's child had been 10 years old.
We were never given the name of the little boy. However, the name of the man who had allegedly fathered this child was Thomas. The third article told of her suicide. This woman had taken herself out into the woods and had hanged herself. And there was a photograph of the living room of the house that this woman had lived in. And it showed the TV and the couch and a coffee table. And sitting on the coffee table, this little square black box with the grey keys and a little, literally a Spectrum rainbow pattern in the corner, was a ZX Spectrum home computer. What the hell is going on? This is just too weird. I wondered, had Gregory somehow overheard a conversation about the case? Maybe were the Finnegans in some way related to this family? But again, I realized I was grasping at straws, and I was now starting to think, I really don't know what's going on anymore.
But Shane kept poking at it. According to one newspaper clipping, there was a local priest who had befriended the woman, and he was still alive. But when Shane went to see him, the man didn't want to talk. Shane was running out of leads to chase.
I got a call from Orla. She was borderline hysterical.
Gregory was gone, but this time it was different. Orla had been preparing breakfast in the kitchen when suddenly Gregory shot past her and out the back door. She called after him, only to see him run into the woods. And he wasn't alone. There was another boy pulling Gregory by the hand.
We did call the police, but there was their reaction was, looking at, literally, he's only gone. He's gone an hour. He's run away before. If he's not back by this evening, give us a call again, kind of thing. They were growing weary of the case at that stage. I called George Taylor, the principal of the school, who was my friend and who knew the woods intimately.
And he had the principal guide them through the woods to try and find the two boys.
We could see two distinct sets of tracks, and they were heading north. Eventually, after a couple of hours, we came across a kind of a hollow in the woods. In that hollow, there was an old shack, an old stone ruin. Gregory was lying up against the wall of this shack asleep, which I thought was very strange, why he would have gone to sleep, but he was. I went down into the hollow to Gregory. I remember I kneeled down beside him and woke him up. As I did that, suddenly we heard the sound of a child crying. This seemed to be coming from all around us and kind of in my head as well. I said to Gregory, you know, where's Thomas? Where is he? He said, he's over there. I looked over and there was a child standing a distance away in the trees. Could see that he was wearing a kind of a, like an anorak with buttons, and he had a hood up. I remember I took my eye off him to say something again to Gregory, and when I looked up, he was closer, impossibly closer. He couldn't have bridged that distance in the time that it took. And I looked again and he was closer again, and at this stage I could actually see him quite well. You know, I could actually see kind of grass stains or moss stains on the knees of his jeans. And the sound of the crying was even louder. It was so loud it was hurting at times. I remember I picked up Gregory and gave him to George. And George said, look, we have to get out of here. You know, we need to go. But there was still part of me that wanted to help this kid. Here he was standing right in front of me. and he looked like a boy. I held out my hand. I said, come on, come with us. You know, we can talk about whatever's going on. As I said that, something crossed his face. I don't know whether it was a look of fear or a look of anger or a look of uncertainty, but it was like a rope had been tied around his waist and suddenly it had been pulled back through the trees. He was gone. Just whoosh. The sound stopped. The crying wasn't there anymore. We took Gregory and we started walking back home. And I remember him saying to me, is he gone now? Is Thomas gone? I didn't have an answer. I didn't know what to say. One afternoon, I'm in the office and suddenly I look up and Father Malone is standing in the doorway.
Father Malone is a local priest Shane had tried talking to days before.
And he's clearly very distressed. And he tells me that he had to come clean.
He did know more about the woman in the woods. Father Malone had visited her often.
She told him that she had been having violent thoughts towards her son. She had been thinking about killing him. He said that he hadn't really known what to do. So he just offered a listening ear. Then this one afternoon, he arrived out to the house. He knocked on the door and there was no answer. And he was about to leave when he saw the woman walking out of the trees. There was blood on her clothes, smears of blood on her face. She told him that she had murdered her son.
When Father Malone went to the police, they didn't bother to investigate.
Everybody believed that the boy didn't exist, that this was a figment of the woman's imagination.
A month later, the woman hung herself.
Father Malone told me sort of that what we were seeing was the unquiet ghost or the spirit of this little boy who had been murdered. Well, I kind of didn't really know what to say other than it added up. It I suppose, kind of almost completed a circle in terms of everything that had been going on. A couple of days later, Father Malone and Orla and Gregory and myself went into the woods and we had a candlelight ceremony.
They didn't go too far into the woods, just about 20 yards from the Finnegan's house, and they stood in a loose circle.
Gregory held candles, which during the ceremony, Father Malone lit them from a sacred candle that he had brought with him. Now, to be clear, this was not an exorcism or anything like that. Father Malone wanted to acknowledge what had happened to Thomas. And I know that closure is quite important, but as to what the outcome was going to be, I really had no idea. He said a few words, just blessing Thomas and, you know, that we all wished for him to be accepted into heaven.
Shane had explained to Gregory that they were saying goodbye to his friend.
I think he felt glad that Thomas had gone somewhere where he was happy and safe. At one point out of the corner of my eye, I fancied I might have seen a little figure among the trees, but, you know, I don't know whether any of that was just what you expect in a situation like that. Then we went back to the house and had tea. That was the last anybody saw of Thomas. He didn't come back.
A very big thank you to Shane Dunphy for sharing his story with the Snap. And you've got to know, there is more, so much more. We'll have a link to Shane's book, The Boy They Tried to Hide, at snapjudgment.org. The original score and sound design for that piece was by Pat and C.D. Miller, and it was produced by Nancy Lopez. Snappers, please note, in celebration of the haunting season, Snap Judgment has released 4 podcast only spook specials, including Welcome to the Dollhouse. They're only available where you get your podcast. Be afraid. I'm going to snap judgment. The Pitch Black episode continues. We've got a story from the Borderlands that will stop you cold. Snap judgment. Spooked 7 Pitch Black will be right back in a moment. Do not turn off the lights. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Spook 7 Pitch Black special. We're chasing after creatures that go bump in the night, and our next guest story takes place in a no man's land. Rocky Elmore is a retired Border Patrol agent, but back in the 90s, he was stationed just east of San Diego, right along the border fence, at a place called Otay Mountain.
And the border fence stopped at the foothills of Otay Mountain at a place called the Well Draw, and we also called it the Ended Fence. It is by far the roughest terrain anywhere on the U.S.-Mexico border. There were no residual lighting, no ambient lighting up there other than what the moonlight or stars might provide. Sometimes I got out of the vehicle and the vehicle totally disappeared, even though it was no further than 3 or 4 feet away. It was that dark. And according to the Kumeyaay tribe that lived in that area and had for many hundreds of years, it was forbidden for human beings to go up on Otay, and they never went up there. The only people that were ever up there were the people crossing over the mountain trying to get north and the agents up there trying to catch them. So we would wind up in a situation where we would be on one hilltop and they'd be on the next ridge top, looking at each other and watching each other through binoculars and waiting for sundown to come and then try to see who was going to outmaneuver the other. What I wasn't quite ready for was the amount of physical closeness and contact it required to catch somebody in total darkness. We quite often laid in on the trail that the traffic would be coming down, maybe 1 foot off of it. And then you would begin to hear footsteps. You'd begin to hear the brush breaking. And you listen to them walk up to you, and you notice your breathing starts to get shallow. Your heart starts to race. Then when they got close enough, you merely stepped out on the trail and grabbed hold of the first person in line, which is the most dangerous person in the group, the smuggler. But even a hardcore smuggler, when he's taken by surprise, will completely just freeze for about a second. And you've got a second to say, in a voice not much more than a whisper, "Set down." This is something that nightmares are made of. This is something the boogeyman is made of. And after a while, you realize that you've become the boogeyman you once feared. So there's just this eeriness across the whole range that something just wasn't right. And maybe it was the silence. I don't know. It was just a very eerie place. And sometimes an agent will see something kind of strange. And guys don't want to talk about weird stuff. It's a good way to end your career. It's a good way to get laughed at and ridiculed. But every now and then, an agent, once he got to know you a little bit, trust you a little bit, would tell maybe one story. And everyone knew the story about Luis Santiago. Agent Santiago was originally from Ponce, Puerto Rico. And when we were in the same training unit, everyone noticed how worried he was about getting killed. And we were sitting outside on our lunch break, and about 10 of us was gathered around talking. And he said, "If you run into a group of 20 up there and they jump you, you're just dead, and that's it." And we all liked him, but he was comical. And we just thought he was being funny again, and we all laughed when he said it, and then went on about our business. But the night that I was actually supposed to work with Agent Santiago, I came down with a pretty bad cold. So I stayed home that night, and I was awoken from my sleep with this rhythmic beeping. Sounded kind of like a distress signal or something. And I hear it coming from inside my closet where I stored my equipment. So I open the closet door up and I pick up my work walkie-talkie. And I thought, well, it must have a short in it. And it was turned off and I turned it on and back off again and the beeping stopped. So I looked over at the clock and the clock said 12:02. The next morning I got a phone call and they told me that they had detected traffic coming up the cliffs at Down Canyon. But Agent Santiago, for some reason, broke away from the training officer and the other trainees, and he ran to the top of the cliff. Now, nobody knows for sure if he saw somebody up there or why he did that. But as he got up to the top of the cliff, everyone heard a scream. And they looked over and they saw Agent Santiago's light tumbling down the cliff. He landed on the rocks down below, and it had killed him instantly. And the estimated time of death was about 1 or 2 minutes after midnight. Officially, the death was ruled an accident, but nobody ever really believed that. And over the years, many different smugglers and guides have come forward saying they had information about Agent Santiago's death. That tells you that something was there. It wasn't an accident. So we all believe that there was a smuggler up there and the smuggler had pushed him over. I was in the processing area in our jail area where we process all the prisoners before we send them back. And a friend of mine, Bill, come over and said, "Hey, Rocky, those prisoners over there said they seen Santiago." And it really caught me by surprise, and I didn't even know what to think about it. And I started to get quite angry because I thought they were mocking his death. And Bill said, "No, Rocky, the prisoners said they seen Agent Santiago up on the mountain." And I walked over and looked at them, and those guys looked pretty shook up. They looked like they'd seen a ghost. And that was kind of the beginning of it. But a few days later, I was back in the field myself, and I was up on the mountain. And we had a group coming over, about 30 to 35 people. And then the agents on top said, "They've just stopped on the road for some reason. I don't know why. They're just standing there." I said, "Okay, well, let us know when they get moving." A couple minutes went by, and I called Miguel back up. I said, "Hey, Miguel, are they moving yet?" He said, "Nope." I said, "I don't know what happened." He said, "We hear crying in the group, and I think somebody stopped them." And when we got there, the whole group was still just standing in the road, which is very unusual because the first thing we always have everyone do is sit down. Some of the people were still crying, and they started telling us that a phantom Border Patrol agent had blocked their path and stopped them. And he told them that they were not going to pass and everyone was going to wait there. And he identified himself as Luis Santiago. First off, we thought, well, this must be a real agent just playing a joke. It's a very sick joke, and we don't like it, we don't appreciate it, but it's got to be that. And it was the groups themselves that finally convinced us that this most definitely was nobody playing a trick. All of them said, "We can see through him, he's transparent, he floats across the terrain as he walks." So these encounters started stacking up, and eventually the story just got out. It was just happening too much. And this was one of those rare occasions where ghost stories and the paranormal was talked about out in the open at the station, even by management, and nobody was laughing. Everyone was just shaking their head. It's like, I have no idea what's going on, but this is legit. And as time went by, his apparition was seen progressively moving toward the dam at Otay Lakes. And it was moving that way along one of the routes. And we didn't know what to do with it or do about it. The traffic even started to cease in that area after dark. We got feedback that some of the smugglers were afraid to take their groups there. Some of the agents didn't even want to work the area. They were scared. In one case, a group had gotten left behind by their guide, and they had run out of water, had no food, and they were just about done for. And they were telling this to the agents the next day that had caught them. They said a Border Patrol agent came up to us last night, but he didn't seem real. But he started to talk to us, and he told us, if we follow this trail, you'll find water at the bottom. And we did exactly like he told us, and he saved our lives. And that kind of told us that Santiago's vendetta was against the guides. And when he found a group that was about to perish and didn't have a smuggler with them, he helped them. And that was the only time he ever helped a group. One night, I was assigned to the Dam area, and I sat for 2 or 3 hours next to the cliffs where Agent Santiago fell. And by that time, I had heard, 10 or 15 of these different encounters, and my head was just swimming, trying to figure out what's going on with this, and, why is this happening? And I actually hiked down, I climbed down the cliffs to the bottom where Agent Santiago had died. All the medical equipment was still there from when they had tried to treat him. The sheet was there, the gloves. And it was like a fresh kick in the gut. And I began to wonder, had I not been sick and been there, would that change the equation? Would this not have happened? And after a few minutes of that, I just climbed back to the top of the cliff, tried to put my mind on something else. And then finally, on January 22nd, 1996, there was a group detected coming up those cliffs. Agent Arlo responded to it. And when he got there, this group started screaming that a Border Patrol agent shooting his weapon had chased them toward that cliff. 6 of them went off the cliff, and 1 of them was killed instantly. But the man killed was the smuggler. So Agent Arlo, the agent that responded first, came under suspicion of having done this. And the FBI did a paraffin test on his hand and his weapon, and it came back that Arlo had not fired a gun, and his weapon had not been fired either. So that kind of cleared him, but he's still their suspect. So they do a lineup, and the people who survived that didn't go over the edge can't pick Arlo out of the lineup. And they're actually very insistent that it was not Arlo that chased him over. It was a different agent. So they're kind of hitting a dead end here. And then finally, one of the agents that was helping the FBI in the investigation walked out, went into the hallway, took a photo down, and he didn't say anything to the FBI. He said, "Why don't you show this to him?" And all of them immediately identified the man in the picture as the one who chased them toward the cliff shooting at them. So the FBI said, call this guy in and let's get him. And then that's when the Border Patrol agents told them, said, "Well, you can't." And they said, "Why?" And the agent told them, "Because that's Agent Luis Santiago, and he was killed on that cliff last year." The theory that makes the most sense to me is that the smuggler that went over in that very last encounter was the one that pushed him over, and he got his vengeance for his own death. No one ever claimed to see a phantom Border Patrol agent again after that. But the night of his memorial service, I went home and went to bed, and I was sleeping along pretty sound. And in the middle of the night, I was woken up by the very same distress signal that I had heard the night of Santiago's death. And sure enough, it was my radio going off again. And I looked over at the clock, and the clock said 12:02. So I was just sitting there holding it this time, and shivers were going up and down my spine because now it had a whole new meaning. And I had this overwhelming feeling that somebody was on that radio and they wanted me to press that talk button and say something. And I couldn't do it because I was convinced I would get an answer back if I did. I don't know what I would have said to him. I guess I didn't know if he would say, "Where were you? Why weren't you there? Why didn't you come to work that night?" Or if he was just going to say goodbye. I didn't know. I just didn't have the courage to press that button and find out.
Thank you so much to Rocky Elmore for sharing this story of SNAP. Rocky actually has a lot more, and I do mean a lot more stories about things both natural and supernatural from his time on the border. Check out his book, Out on Foot, Nightly Patrols and Ghostly Tales of a U.S. Border Patrol Agent. We'll have links at snapjudgment.org. The original score for that story was by none other than Renzo Gorio. You're listening to Snap Judgment, the Spook 7 Pitch Black Special. And because nobody loves All Hallowed Eve like Snap loves All Hallowed Eve, we've unleashed 4 podcast-only spook specials, including The Hounds of Hell. Get them wherever you get your podcasts or at snapjudgment.org. And please, please, don't listen alone. When Spook 7 returns, we pull back the curtain on a secret world. Be afraid. Snap Judgment. From WNYC Studios, you're listening to Snap Judgment, the Spook 7 Pitch Black Special. My name is Glenn Washington, and I want you to move toward the light before this next story, because the light may be your only defense. See, before he went to medical school, Don Clark worked with developmentally delayed patients in a group home in Philadelphia. That job opened his eyes and challenged everything that he believed about life and about death. Snap Judgment.
I'm Donald Clark. I am a family doctor. The year before I went to medical school, I was a house parent for 3 men who had been patients at a state institution for developmentally delayed people. So it was a 3-story house. We had a very strict rule, as well as for our own privacy, that the guys would not be allowed to go on the 3rd floor. That was our space. Al was in his 30s, and very soon after birth, he was diagnosed with an extremely rare syndrome that leaves a person blind from birth, and for reasons that aren't clear, they usually die in their 30s. Al shuffled. He was short, he was overweight. He shuffled, and he would run his hand down the side of a wall if he was indoors. You could always tell when Al was coming. First time I met Al, he sidled up to me, he put his hand on my forearm, and then he found my elbow, and then he just went all the way up to my shoulder. He figured out pretty quick that I was a big guy. So when Al got frustrated, he would suddenly stop and freeze and then start to shake, and then he would just start lashing out. Prior to me coming, he broke one of the other house parents' arm, and he never attacked me. And I think this is why he and I were able to bond, is because I wasn't scared of him. I got to be better at recognizing when he was starting to tense up. I think his life did calm down during that time we were in the house together. I went away for a camping trip with some friends, and I got home Sunday night. The other house parent told me that Al had died. It was in the evening. The guys were in watching the TV. One of the other guys, who was not verbal at all, but kept pointing at Al, and then he realized that Al was dead, was not moving. I felt terrible. That I just felt like I should have been there. I just had that bond with him, and it was that night. I went to bed, and I just lay there. I just did not move. I was just lying there questioning whether or not I was really hearing what I thought I was hearing. I couldn't believe it. I can hear his walk, his breathing, his hand on the banister on one side and on the wall on the other. I was incredulous. He comes in my room without pausing. He comes over to the bed and sits on the foot of the bed, on the corner of the bed. He did not look like a ghost. There was no bed sheet. There was no, you know, that kind of being able to see through him partly or anything. He looked like Al. So I wasn't scared. I just couldn't believe what was happening. So Al, when he was confused, he got a particular look on his face, and he would purse his lips and twist them in a particular way. And it was kind of cute. So Al is sitting there on the side of my bed, down there on the foot, and he has got that look on his face, and he's thinking real hard about something. First, I said, Al, what are you doing up here? You know you're not allowed on the third floor. He's thinking real hard. He's got his lips pursed like that. And he finally says,
Don, I'm dead.
And I said, yeah, Al, you are. And he thought some more. And then he said,
Don, what do I do now?
And I said, I don't know, Al. I'm sorry, but you can't stay here. You're going to have to leave. And he sat there and thought about that for a long time. And then he got up and shuffled out of the room, and his feet and his hands and his breathing went on down the hall and down the stairs, and he was gone. I got up and felt the corner of the bed to see if it was warm or cold, like a ghost is supposed to leave, you know, the cold and whatever. And there was, you know, I felt nothing unusual, either warmth or cold. I just could not believe it. I consider myself to be a rational person. I practice evidence-based medicine, and I believe in science, and I still don't believe that death is a two-way door. It's a one-way, and so I cannot explain any of this, and I can't reconcile it with any of my other beliefs. This did happen, and I've just had to say, okay, it happened. I do believe Al came to me because of our relationship, and he trusted me. I wasn't there when he died, and I felt bad about that, but, you know, he waited for me to find out what he was supposed to do. I wish I could have told him better, but, you know, I'm somehow feel that he's figured it out in his own way, because it was Al. He just walked in, we talked, and he walked out.
Don Clark is a Snap Judgment listener, a big snapper. He wrote in to share this story with us. Thanks so much for scaring me half to death, Don. The original score and sound design for that story was by Leon Morimoto. It was produced by Eliza Smith. Know this, Spooked 7 is not over. It will never die. It can never die. Bring out the silver bullets and the holy water, because we've got 4 podcast-only spook specials waiting for you right now. See pictures. Let us know what you think of Spooked on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, snapjudgment.org. Snap was produced by the team that never walks alone. Please give it up for the Crypt Keeper himself, the Uber producer, Mark Ristich. He is risen. Pat Masiti Miller. Anna Sussman wants your blood. Nancy Lopez sleeps under her bed. Joe Rosenberg sleeps over his. Eliza Smith doesn't sleep. David Kim thinks holy water will save him. Teo de Cot knows better. Renzo, the screaming Goryeo. Leon Morimoto leaves no trace. Lisa Egan and Liz Mack have feasted on the unspeakable. And if you ask Jasmine Aguilera no questions, Jasmine Aguilera will tell you no lies. As you may have surmised, this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could wake up in the dark only to realize this isn't your bed, and this isn't just dark. And are you wearing a suit? What is this box? It feels like the inside of a coffin. And even then you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNYC.